Chapter 2. Never let a global pandemic go to waste. Quote, "You never want a serious crisis to go to waste," end quote. Rahm Emanuel speaking at a conference hosted by the Wall Street Journal, November 19th, 2008. Yeah, I know, you've heard this infamous never let a crisis go to waste quote from Rahm Emanuel before, and if you're a conservative, you probably heard it a lot over the years from Republican politicians, writers, even me. Anybody was trying to illustrate how establishment politicians like Rahm Emanuel, the former chief of staff for President Barack Obama and former mayor of Chicago, try to use disasters as opportunities to achieve liberal, progressive, or socialist goals. I know I've talked about that quote dozens of times on the air, and I've heard other conservatives and politicians do the same more times than I can count, which is a lot, by the way. I'm a pretty good counter. However, rarely have I taken the time to read the full quote during my radio or television show. When I sat down to write this chapter, I went back through my notes and I read the Emanuel quote in its entirety. And I realized not only have many conservatives slightly changed the quote over the years, but they've also been neglecting a key detail, one that makes Emanuel's statement much more relevant and powerful today than ever before. Emanuel made the crisis comment way back in November 2008, just after Barack Obama won the presidential election. The United States was still in the midst of what at that time was the most significant economic crash in modern American history. Although by today's chaotic standards, it seems like your average Wednesday. Speaking at a conference hosted by the Wall Street Journal, Emanuel said, quote, "You never want a serious crisis to go to waste." And what I mean by that is an opportunity to do things that you think you could not do before. I think America as a whole in 1973 and 1974, and not just my view, but obviously the administration's, missed the opportunity to deal with the energy crisis that was before us. For a long time, our energy policy came down to cheap oil. This is an opportunity. What used to be long-term problems, be they in the healthcare area, energy area, education, fiscal, tax area, regulatory reform area, things that we have postponed for far too long, that were long-term, are now immediate and must be dealt with. This crisis provides the opportunity for us. As I would say, the opportunity to do things that you could not do before. The good news, I suppose, if you want to see a silver lining, is the problems are big enough that they lend themselves to ideas from both parties for the solution. Now, did you pick up on that? There are a few important parts of Emanuel's statement that often get overlooked. First, Emanuel doesn't say, never let a crisis go to waste. He says, you never want a serious crisis to go to waste. Now, that might seem like a small difference, but the serious part of the statement is important. Small crises, they happen all the time. That's how most of the news industry makes its money. But it is the serious crisis that presents real opportunities for radical change. Emanuel reiterates this point later on in the statement when he says, the good news, I suppose, if you want to see a silver lining, is the problems are big enough that they lend themselves to ideas from both parties for the solution. See, Emanuel's argument is not that any small problem can be transformed into a larger issue that leads to change, but rather that big alterations to our existing system, the kinds of radical things Barack Obama and Rahm Emanuel wanted to achieve, are not normally possible without serious crisis. So there's also another important part of the statement worth thinking about more carefully. Emanuel does not say that the 2008 financial crisis provided Democrats with the chance to enhance their own reforms, but rather he says the crisis allowed both parties to provide the solution. Now, you might be tempted to dismiss that part of his statement as pandering, but if the coronavirus pandemic has taught us anything, It is that many Republicans are just as eager to find ways to expand the power of government and their corporate friends as their more left-wing rivals on the other side of the aisle. The only difference between many Republicans and Democrats in Congress is no longer whether government should be intricately involved in economic and societal decision-making, but rather the extent to which this should occur. A party deeply devoted to many traditionally conservative ideas, including crazy policies like don't spend more money than you take in, no longer exists in Washington, D.C. Although millions of Americans have been complaining about the gradual shift towards soft authoritarianism that has occurred in both major U.S. political parties over the last couple of decades, the problem has never been more serious than it is now. Those of us who believe in free markets and in individual liberty, in the Bill of Rights, we have few champions in government, and the problem appears to be getting worse. It seems that just about everyone in Washington is now looking for ways to use serious crises to expand their power and make American families increasingly dependent on government, just as Rahm Emanuel suggested. This destructive tendency has been perfectly illustrated by government's reaction to the coronavirus pandemic, which will play a central role in how supporters of the Great Reset plan to implement their radical reforms over the next decade and beyond. Understanding how policymakers have reacted to COVID-19 and taken advantage of this important opportunity for creating change to provide a vital roadmap, we must understand if we are going to fight back against the Great Reset and other attempts to centralize power in the hands of the ruling class. Tyranny goes viral. When most of the mainstream media and political establishment heard about the possibility of a COVID-19 pandemic, they didn't take it seriously. Many people mocked me for sounding the alarm. I guess stories of the Chinese government officials locking people into their own homes by installing bars on their windows and reports of fearful villagers armed with spears tearing up roads so travelers from Wuhan couldn't infect their families, that wasn't enough to grab the attention of the press. Reporters were still too busy drooling uncontrollably over their now mostly forgotten Ukraine-related Trump impeachment hearings. As late as February 2020, many pundits, even global health organizations, were heavily criticizing the Trump administration for limiting travel from China to the United States. Many suggested it was racist and xenophobic, even though the stated purpose of the travel limitations was to clearly prevent the spread of COVID-19 and not to restrict immigration. Politico warned, coronavirus quarantine, travel ban could backfire, experts fear. The New York Times published an article titled, "Who Says It's Not Safe to Travel to China?" in which the author, Rosie Spinks, referred to the political moment as having been dominated by xenophobic rhetoric and the building of walls. Incredibly, the World Health Organization, in an attempt to shield China from criticism, advised that countries like the United States avoid imposing travel bans. Although travel restrictions may intuitively seem like the right thing to do, this is not something that the WHO usually recommends. This is from the spokesperson from the WHO. This is because of the social disruption that they cause and the intensive use of resources required, end quote. But by March 2020, suddenly everything had changed. Instead of mocking President Trump over his decision to reduce travel from China to slow the spread of COVID-19, conservative and liberal pundits alike were demanding that politicians begin to shut down state economies across the country in line with federal government guidelines, even in places where the presence of the virus was virtually non-existent. And unsurprisingly, most government officials were happy to comply. The lockdown orders that followed became so draconian, it inspired me to launch the first ever Chairman Mao Corona Dictator Award Show, complete with Oscar Stiles Maui statues for those engaging in the most tyrannical behavior. By the way, in case you're wondering, and no, I'm not joking, I take the whole Maui Awards very, very seriously. You should watch that episode. My staff and I selected nominees based on viewer-submitted news stories and then sent Maui Awards to the winners. I kind of doubt any of them display the award on their mantle, but they should. It's a really nice-looking award, and they should be proud of how close they came to Chairman Mao. At the first and hopefully last Maui Awards, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio took home the Maui for Best Achievement in mayoral power tripping for his government's decision to restrict church services. Churches that refused to stop worshiping in person were warned they could be permanently shut down if they disobeyed his decree. Of course, Bill de Blasio is not the only one on a power trip. Oregon Governor Kate Brown issued a stay-at-home order that closed most businesses in the state and threatened to punish violators with a $1,250 fine or up to 30 days in jail. Washington Governor Jay Inslee, fresh off his failed campaign to be the Democratic Party's presidential nominee, also closed most businesses in his state and banned nearly all social and recreational gatherings, including funerals and weddings. From March to April 2020, California state and county officials closed much of the Golden State's economy. They mandated stay-at-home orders, released more than 3,500 California state prison inmates, and reduced bail to $0 for those charged with misdemeanors and some lower-level felonies, all in an attempt to slow the spread of the virus. Governor Gretchen Whitmer, Maui winner in the category of Best Gubernatorial Beatdown, issued arguably the most extensive lockdown orders. Whitmer's executive order not only shut down economic activity all across Michigan and outlawed religious gatherings, which sounded like a pretty obvious violation of the whole First Amendment ban on prohibiting the free exercise of religion thing, but she also imposed $1,000 fines on violators and promised to put those who refused to comply with the order in jail for as much as 3 months. A close runner-up in the same category, former Rhode Island Governor Gina Raimondo, who now serves as Commerce Secretary in the Biden White House, called in the state's National Guard to conduct a door-to-door search looking for New Yorkers who had crossed Rhode Island's southern border without a government permission slip. Any New Yorkers that were found were warned about the state's requirement to quarantine for 14 days. By the end of April, more than 40 states, most of which were led by Republicans, had enacted partial or total shutdowns, with many imposing stay-at-home orders with harsh penalties for those who chose not to follow state and local mandates. Then, in a supreme twist of irony, some of the same critics who had previously attacked Trump for issuing his supposedly racist and unnecessary travel ban endlessly criticized the president for seeming too eager to move the country back towards reopening throughout the remainder of the spring and summer. At first, the shutdowns were supposed to last only 2 weeks. And then Americans were told that the primary purpose was to limit the spikes in the coronavirus cases, commonly called flattening the curve, so that hospitals throughout the country would not be overwhelmed and overflowing with patients. Numerous health experts, relying on models predicting a million deaths or more, feared that if the virus were to get out of control, there would not be enough hospital beds and essential medical equipment like ventilator machines to handle the increased demand. One faulty model had an especially large impact on public policy. A team of researchers led by Dr. Neil Ferguson at the Imperial College London predicted that within just 1 year, more than 80% of the U.S. population could get infected with COVID-19, leading to as many as 2.2 million deaths in the United States alone. At the time of this writing, September 22nd, 2021, there have been fewer than 700,000 COVID-19 deaths reported in the United States. Future generations of Americans will struggle to comprehend just how much fear resulted from studies like those put forward by Ferguson. The panic, which was amplified by a continuous stream of dire reports from the media, provided policymakers with the justification they needed to enact just about any dictate they pleased, including a number of mandates that they knew would have little or no impact on the spread of the coronavirus. In Michigan, Maui Award winner Governor Whitmer banned residents, and I'm quoting, from traveling between homes they own in the state or to vacation rentals, end quote. According to the Detroit News, it was further reported that Whitmer's executive order required, quote, large retail stores to cordon off areas dedicated to furniture, gardening, and paint, preventing stores that were allowed by the state to be open from selling their non-essential products. Okay. New York pastor Samson Ryman, who leads Central Bible Baptist Church, was threatened in May 2020 with a $1,000 fine for holding a drive-in church service with 40 members of his congregation. Greenville, Mississippi, congregants attending a similar drive-in church service were fined $500 each for refusing to comply with a curfew order issued by the city's mayor. In Kentucky, officials placed a couple under house arrest, electronic ankle bracelets and all, after a woman, Elizabeth Lynn Scott, tested positive for COVID-19. Incredibly, Lynn Scott had taken the test voluntarily as a precautionary measure prior to visiting her grandparents. After she tested positive, health officials told Lynn Scott she needed to sign papers that would require her to ask the local health department for permission prior to leaving her house for any reason. Lynn Scott agreed to self-quarantine, but she refused to sign the papers, which she said went too far. According to Lynn Scott, they would have prevented her, for instance, from going to the hospital in a medical emergency without first begging for permission from the government. Soon after Lynn Scott's refusal, the local sheriff's department arrived at her door demanding that she sign the health department's mandate. Quote, I open up the door and there's like 8 different people, 5 different cars, and I'm like, what the heck is going on? Said Isaiah Lynn Scott, Elizabeth's husband. This guy's in a suit with a mask, the health department guy, and they have 3 papers for us, for me, for her, and for my daughter, end quote. The officials forced the couple to wear ankle monitors and to notify them if they needed to travel more than 200 feet from their house. Geez, we didn't rob a store. We didn't steal something. We didn't hit and run. We didn't do anything wrong, Elizabeth Lynn Scott said. Is it just me, or do you also imagine that the government officials at Lynn Scott's door looked a little like a group of KGB agents demanding papers, please? A self-imposed economic depression. Now, by issuing stay-at-home orders and the other wildly authoritarian mandates, governments did not nearly harm America's economy. They shot the economy in the head and callously dumped its body in the East River, Godfather style. Prior to the lockdowns going into effect, the U.S. economy had been booming for 3 years. Unemployment for African Americans, Asians, Hispanics, women, and just about everyone else was at or near all-time lows. In late 2019 and early 2020, the Dow Jones Industrial Average and other key stock market indexes hit record highs, boosting millions of Americans' retirement accounts. Medium home prices in the fourth quarter of 2019 were also nearing their all-time high. But just a few months after the world learned about COVID-19 and ruling class elites locked down states, the U.S. economy experienced an unprecedented collapse. The number of Americans usually working full-time dropped by more than 16.7 million from January 2020 to April 2020. The unemployment rate for all workers rose from 3.5% in February to 14.7% in April. It was an increase of 320% in 2 months. By the end of May 2020, more than 40 million Americans had filed for unemployment. African Americans were hit especially hard. In the fourth quarter of 2019, black unemployment had reached its lowest recorded quarterly level in all of U.S. history, averaging 5.6%. By the end of April, it had skyrocketed to 16.7, a level that had not been seen since the height of the Obama-era Great Recession in 2010 and 11. Millions of businesses either closed or were forced to apply for the federal government's Paycheck Protection Program, PPP, which provided hundreds of billions of dollars to businesses to keep unemployment from continuing to spiral out of control. Not since the Great Depression has an economic collapse of this magnitude occurred. But unlike the Great Depression, the coronavirus crash was deliberately created by government, with widespread support from large corporations. It is almost certainly the first time in world history that a country as powerful as the United States chose consciously to decimate its own economy. A tremendous opportunity. There is no denying that for many, although not necessarily all, the initial motivation behind the decision to close the U.S. economy was fear. Some policymakers truly believed that millions of people would soon be dead from an unstoppable global pandemic, and that the only hope that the country had of saving those lives was to force Americans to stay in their homes no matter the cost. But regardless of whether you think that it was the right or wrong decision, it is not an unreasonable position to take. No one wants to be remembered as the callous monster who voted in favor of millions of people dying. However, within the first 30 days of the lockdown, it became very clear that the models which health experts told us were the world's most accurate would, in some cases, be off by more than a million deaths, and that the death rates for those infected by the virus were significantly lower than what originally had been estimated. And outside of a relatively small number of urban areas, hospitals were not overflowing, which, again, was the primary concern of health officials in the earliest days of the pandemic. Health officials were initially so concerned about hospital capacity that in late March 2020, President Trump ordered the U.S. Navy to send a massive hospital ship, the CSNS Comfort, from Norfolk, Virginia. They parked it in New York Harbor. But shortly after the ship arrived, its crew reduced the hospital capacity from 1,000 to 500 because of the lower-than-expected demand. And by mid-April, 90% of the ship's beds hadn't been used. Yet the lockdowns continued in nearly every state. Why? Well, some public health experts, including many of the same people who had previously overestimated the danger of the virus, said that extending the lockdowns was important for protecting public health. This was despite the fact that there was virtually no danger of reaching bed capacity limits in the vast majority of U.S. hospitals. These same experts further argued that the government had now taken on itself the responsibility to save as many lives as possible from being harmed by COVID-19, regardless of the damage that it would cause to our society or to the economy or even to public health. The narrative from public health officials shifted from flatten the curve to save lives by staying home. And some pundits and activists suddenly realized that their self-inflicted economic crisis caused by the coronavirus pandemic opened the window to radical changes that had previously seemed politically impossible. They couldn't let this once-in-a-lifetime crisis go to waste, right? Others, however, had already been planning to take advantage of a scenario like the coronavirus pandemic well before anyone had ever heard of COVID-19. Most people don't know, and you can verify this, you can watch the entire conference on YouTube. Maybe, if it's still there. October 29th, public health experts and policy wonks from a number of institutions, including Johns Hopkins University, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and the World Economic Forum, one of the most prominent supporters of the Great Reset, met at the Pierre Hotel in New York City. Now, the goal of this meeting was to conduct a simulation that presented attendees with a series of dramatic scenario-based facilitated discussions, confronting difficult, true-to-life dilemmas associated with a response to a hypothetical, but scientifically plausible, coronavirus pandemic. The primary purpose of the pandemic exercise, which was creepily named Event 201, was to develop recommended actions for government officials, international organizations, and private businesses to take in order to achieve, quote, unprecedented levels of collaboration, end quote, during the next pandemic, providing a partial foundation for what would become the Great Reset. The Event 201 meeting was just a thought experiment, but by mid-March 2020, public fear of COVID-19 had given politicians the chance to play these war games for real. As Democrats started to quietly discuss how they would take advantage of the pandemic, on March 19th, The Hill reported that during an important conference call featuring more than 200 members of the House Democratic Caucus, lawmakers, one by one, laid out a sweeping wish list of provisions they wanted to see, end quote, in Congress's initial COVID-19 relief package, quote, including a boost in infrastructure spending, an expansion of Social Security benefits, and funding for states to set up an all-mail voting system in the event the pandemic extends into the November elections. James Clyburn, a Democrat from South Carolina who was then serving as the House Majority Whip and had become a key political ally of Joe Biden, said during the call that the pandemic was a, quote, tremendous opportunity to restructure things to fit our vision, end quote. Well, that vision included a wide range of proposed government programs and pet projects, including cash payments to individuals, low-cost loans for small businesses, new funding to boost the healthcare system, and a financial lifeline for the hardest-hit industries like aviation and cruise lines, as well as $300 million for refugees and migrants, $35 million in funding for the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts, new fuel emission standards, and a new climate change study, end quote. Of course, establishment congressional Republicans were not going to allow this tremendous opportunity to pass them by either. In July 2020, Senate Republicans hosted a caucus meeting to discuss their strategy for negotiating another round of coronavirus relief. After the meeting finished, Rand Paul, one of the few voices of reason left in the Senate, lambasted the members of his own party for their rampant hypocrisy. Quote, they, the congressional Republicans, said that President Obama is for borrowing and spending. Well, they're talking about spending another $1 trillion. There should be a law that they're no longer allowed to talk about the debt, said Paul, who later called government's lack of fiscal restraint an abomination, end quote, and said, quote, there is no difference now between the two parties in spending, end quote. A whole book could be dedicated entirely to talking about the thousands of provisions contained in the coronavirus relief packages passed in 2020 and early 2021. But the following three best illustrate the absolutely mind-exploding insanity that government passed into law after choosing to shut down the economy. One, stimulus checks. Perhaps the most notable and far-reaching coronavirus relief program involved sending most adults in the United States $1,200 in stimulus money resulting from a provision contained in the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, commonly called the CARES Act. Under the program, individuals earning $75,000 or less received $1,200, plus $500 for every qualifying child age 17 or younger, up to a specified limit. Married couples earning $150,000 or less received $2,400. By early June 2020, the federal government had sent 159 million payments, amounting to more than $267 billion, plus another $2.5 billion to people living in U.S. territories. Of all of the stupid government programs that have been imposed on the American people, this one takes the cake. These payments were based on income, not need. So tens of millions of people who had not lost their job, not even for a minute during the pandemic, got payments. Even though the purpose of the program, supposedly, was to offer relief to those who required it the most. Proponents of the program defended the seemingly bizarre decision to send money to people who had not lost their employment by saying the payments would also serve as kind of a stimulus for the economy. The idea was that millions of people who received checks but hadn't lost their jobs would go out somehow or another and spend the cash, helping the economy recover from the coronavirus crash. Besides the government's inability to pay for this huge cash giveaway, there was another glaring problem with this ridiculous theory. The economy had been mostly shut down. So there were very few places people could go other than massive corporate retailers to spend their hot-off-the-press government-printed money. Huh. What's the point of a stimulus plan if there's almost nothing to stimulate, other than Jeff Bezos' bank account, of course? It is also worth remembering that the program was based on 2019 tax data, not 2020 income levels. So that means some people who experienced large drops in their income in 2020 didn't receive, you know, the immediate payment, while others who had enjoyed a significant increase in their income in 2020 received $1,200 that they didn't need. Even more stunning, a Democratic-led Congress and President Biden passed another gigantic COVID-19 relief law in early 2021, this time with a $1.9 trillion price tag. Among other things, the law sent $1,400 in direct payments to Americans, even though all signs suggested that the coronavirus pandemic was winding down, not getting worse. 2. Unemployment bonuses. In addition to handing out $1,200 payments, government officials in 2020 also sent unemployed workers a $600 per week unemployment bonus that supplemented unemployment payments already received by workers through state programs. The arguments behind the $600 payment was that Americans who lost their jobs because of the shutdowns would have their income completely replaced by the government, since it was the government that caused the unemployment in the first place. Well, at least that part makes sense. I mean, if the government were to come to your house and burn it down, or just burn down your garage, shouldn't they be the ones that would pay for a new garage or a new house? The unemployment bonuses went much further than this, though. Instead of limiting the payments to total amount earned while employed, Congress's program, which we should not forget, had also been approved by President Trump, allowed people to receive more in unemployment payments than they earned while working. This logically destroyed the incentive those people would otherwise have to go find another job. So instead of just replacing the garage that it burnt down, the government threw in a new gazebo that they could burn down as well. In May 2020, 538 reported, quote, "A new analysis by Peter Ganong, Pascal Noel, and Joseph Vavra, economists at the University of Chicago, uses government data from 2019 to estimate that 68% of unemployed workers who can receive benefits are eligible for payments that are greater than their lost earnings." And the government just didn't merely pay people a little more than their full salaries to stay home either. In many cases, Congress paid recipients significantly more. Ganong, Noel, Vavra, quote, "found that the estimated median replacement rate in 2020, the share of workers' original weekly salary that is being replaced by unemployment benefits, is 134%, or more than one-third above their original wage. A substantial minority of those workers, particularly in low-wage professions like food service and janitorial work, may end up receiving more than 150% of their previous weekly salary. Although some said the bonuses were meant to only help people get through the short economic shutdown lasting just a month or two, by mid-July, 30 million Americans were still receiving the bonuses. And in the 2021 legislation signed into law by President Biden, the bonus payments were extended again, although the maximum amount provided was reduced to $300 per week. 3. Medicaid madness. In March 2020, Congress passed and President Trump signed the CARES Act and the Family First Corona Response Act. Nope, that doesn't spell anything cool. Anyway, anticipating additional Medicare costs, Congress provided in these laws more Medicaid-related funding for states, which share the cost of Medicaid enrollees with the federal government. However, rather than simply offering states additional cash to help them get through the pandemic, Congress tied strings to the money that required states accepting the additional funds would have to keep Medicaid beneficiaries enrolled in the program even after they would ordinarily lose their eligibility. Researchers at the Foundation for Government Accountability noted in their 2020 report that in order to receive the additional funds, quote, states cannot remove even ineligible enrollees unless those enrollees request a voluntary termination, end quote. Quote, states are also blocked from strengthening eligibility standards, methodologies, and procedures, and cannot increase premiums beyond those in effect in January 2020. This, the authors of the report said, they also block states from requiring local governments to increase contributions to Medicaid, end quote. This disastrous provision put states in a terrible situation, forcing them to choose between missing out on federal funds or accepting completely unsustainable terms. Quote, ultimately, these restrictions will prevent some states from receiving COVID-19 aid, exacerbate the state budget crisis stemming from the pandemic, strip states of needed tools to manage Medicaid, rob resources from the truly needy, and bind states' hands for decades to come, the FGA authors wrote. According to the FGA's report, this absurd provision made it possible for Americans in states that expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act of 2010 to lose their job, enroll in Medicaid, get a new job with a larger salary, and yet stay enrolled in Medicaid. Now, why in the world would Congress force states to continue enrolling Medicaid beneficiaries to people who found good-paying jobs, other than, of course, because it wants to get as many people as it can hooked on a costly government program? A war on small business. Making matters even worse, many of the COVID-19 lockdown and relief policies disproportionately benefited groups and businesses favored politically. In her remarkable book, The War on Small Business, How the Government Used the Pandemic to Crush the Backbone of America, Carol Roth, an entrepreneur and former investment banker in Wall Street, outlines in great detail how the coronavirus policies imposed by governments throughout much of 2020 decimated small businesses while allowing many large corporations to remain at least partially open. Summarizing the war on small business at the height of the pandemic lockdowns, Roth writes, government entities, the same ones that were supposed to protect property rights and all the individual rights, told many businesses, primarily small businesses, that they were considered non-essential and that they would have to shut down, some in whole, some in part. That was it. Millions of businesses across the country received directives to close, but nothing else. No compensation for helping the government or society, no special provisions to safeguard their own or their staff's livelihoods, just pack it in, shut it down, go home, end quote. Additionally, Roth notes how even after Congress put coronavirus relief programs into place, Small businesses ended up with the short end of the stick. With all of the giveaways, you might expect that small businesses would also have been taken care of by the government. The amount of money required to ensure that small businesses stayed open appropriately to compensate them under an eminent domain scenario and preserve jobs was probably in the $1 trillion range. Instead, what small businesses received as part of the CARES Act amounted to less than 20% of the overall relief package. Again, a figure that makes little sense given that small businesses account for half of the economy and are the most vulnerable and most directly affected by the government black swan. Instead of giving money to small business owners quickly and directly, which would have been the most effective tactic and consistent with the direct payments received by the likes of Congress members' cronies, such as the Kennedy Center and universities, Congress cobbled together a shoddy, confusing, forgivable loan program in the PPP. On its own, the lack of adequate funding for small businesses caused substantial harm. But when combined with the advantages that larger corporations had, but many small businesses couldn't get, like large cash reserves, teams of lawyers, tax experts, the ability to shift much of their operations online, the disadvantages faced by countless small businesses were crushing. So why did politicians leave so many small business owners out in the cold during the height of the pandemic? And why didn't corporate America suffer the same fate? The answers to these questions will become evident when the Great Reset is discussed in great detail in Chapter 5. But spoiler alert, short answer, reason corporations were preserved and small businesses destroyed is because of the grand new stakeholder economy dreamt up by the elites in Davos and Biden's White House. Corporations can easily be controlled, manipulating tens of millions of small business owners. That'd be a lot more difficult. I do not believe the coronavirus was released into the public by American officials or Chinese officials on purpose, as some wild conspiracy theorists claim, to destroy the economy and dismantle millions of small businesses. But I do believe that undermining small businesses is considered to be a benefit of the pandemic in the minds of many in the ruling class. No cash, no problem. Before the pandemic hit America, the United States added more than $3 trillion to the national debt from 2016 to 2019. That's $1 trillion a year. And it was also on pace to run another $1 trillion deficit in 2020. This is one of the largest deficits in history. Figures like these used to shock and appall Americans. But I guess in the wake of the federal government's coronavirus spending spree, so what? Not so bad, right? In just the first 6 months of 2020, the national debt, spurred mostly by the coronavirus lockdowns and related government spending programs, increased a gargantuan $3 trillion. But remember, that's just the beginning. Analysts predict that the increased spending and debt caused by the federal government's relief legislation could add a total of $6 trillion to the national debt in just a few years. To put that in perspective, during the 100-year period from 1900 to 2000, the national debt increased by $5.62 trillion. That's after two world wars, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, a decades-long Cold War with Russia, countless foreign operations in countries around the world, Franklin Roosevelt's massive expansion of government and under the New Deal, Lyndon Johnson's even more expensive war on poverty and great society reforms, and seemingly a never-ending war in Afghanistan. But I guess the coronavirus is more important than all that other stuff combined, right? Things have gotten so out of control that President Obama, who added as much money to the national debt as did all other presidents who came before him combined, seems like a real fiscal conservative by today's standards. At least President Obama, on occasion, still pretended to care about the national debt. Congressional Democrats and Republicans, they don't even respect the American people enough to fake it anymore. Hey, politicians and bankers, if you're going to saddle my children, my grandchildren, and my great-great-grandchildren with insurmountable amounts of debt, the least you could do is lie to me when you do it. The national debt is only part of the story. The Federal Reserve balance sheet, a way to track the Fed's assets and liabilities, has been skyrocketing in the wake of the coronavirus response. Increasing the Fed's balance sheet is the real money printing. When the Fed began its quantitative easing QE program, I cover that more in chapter 4, it was directly reflected in the Fed's balance sheet. By the way, just a real quick note on the Fed, the Federal Reserve is not a federal agency. It's actually the five biggest banks in the country. It's all coming together as a private organization that has a partnership with the government. Isn't that great? In 2008, the balance sheet sat around $900 billion. By the end of 2014, after several rounds of just money printing, quantitative easing, the balance sheet peaked at $4.5 trillion. This new number is composed of treasury securities, federal agency debt securities, and a ton of mortgage-backed securities. Remember those in 2008? That didn't work out well. The idea behind QE was to use money printing to drag the country out of the 2008 Great Recession, but then let the balance sheet gradually unwind after the U.S. economy returned to full strength. Well, prior to the coronavirus pandemic, this had very slowly started to occur. By September 2019, the Fed's balance sheet started going down and dipped below $3.8 trillion. If the economy had continued to hum along, it is possible that a further unwinding of this unprecedented QE experiment would have taken place, although it's extremely unlikely that the balance sheet would ever have returned to normal without radical changes to U.S. monetary policy. Of course, all of that's now subject to speculation because COVID-19 happened. In response to the government-induced economic downturn, the Fed once again kicked the money printers into high gear, fueled by purchases of trillions of dollars in treasuries, mortgage-backed securities, and other assets. The Fed's balance sheet is spiking again, this time to unprecedented levels. By the time the pandemic is over, the Fed's balance sheet may end up topping $10 trillion. Not quite Zimbabwe levels of money printing, but I mean, we're just getting warmed up. The reason President Trump and Congress spent more money than even the most liberal American governments of the past dreamed possible, and the reason the Fed is adding trillions more to its balance sheet with no long-term strategy for returning things to normal, is because they've all adopted some version of a radical economic idea called modern monetary theory. Even if they won't admit it publicly, that's what's happening. In Chapter 4, I'll discuss modern monetary theory at length and explain to you the key role it plays in the Great Reset. But for now, all you need to know is that supporters of this theory believe that debts and deficits don't really matter. They argue that as long as a government controls its own currency, like we do in the United States, it can print as much money as it needs to until inflation occurs. Then the government needs to impose new regulations and make reforms to tax and spending policies to target that inflation. Make sure you watch my special on Blaze TV all about this and how it really works. It's The Great Reset. You can find it on Blaze TV. Maybe, perhaps, it's still on YouTube. In some cases, but certainly not all, the folks calling for large increases in spending have adopted MMT without even knowing that the theory existed. I have no doubt that many Democrats and Republicans fall squarely into that camp. But that doesn't change the fact that MMT's foundational principle, that debts and deficits don't really matter that much, has become the new operating standard practice in our brave new Great Reset world. By the way, I'm not the only one who has noticed this important transition to modern monetary theory. In August 2020, in an interview with Robert Hormats, formerly the vice chairman of Goldman Sachs International and an economic and trade policy advisor for five U.S. presidents, acknowledged that America is now essentially practicing modern monetary theory. Quote, "Well," he said during the interview, "we now have a particularly unusual set of circumstances where we're in the midst of forced or involuntary utilization of modern monetary theory," end quote. Quote, "The federal government is issuing and will continue to issue trillions of dollars worth of bonds," Hormats continued, "and the market is, by and large, buying them up at very low interest rates. And the Fed, if the market is not going to do it, the Fed has demonstrated its desire and its willingness to buy those assets up and keep interest rates extremely low," end quote. Now, I know this is going to be hard for some readers to hear, but the evidence is clear that President Trump accepted the basic principles of MMT, and not just because he signed into law costly coronavirus relief legislation without any way of paying for it. Throughout his first term, Trump routinely criticized the Federal Reserve whenever it chose to raise interest rates or even seriously considered a rate increase. In October 2019, responding to a quote suggesting the Fed should raise interest rates, Trump criticized the Fed for considering an interest rate hike, tweeting, "The Fed doesn't have a clue. We have an unlimited potential, only held back by the Federal Reserve," end quote. This is right in line with the views of modern monetary theory. Economists like Stephanie Kelton, a former advisor to Bernie Sanders and professor at Stony Brook University, she and other MMT supporters often dismiss the role of the Fed altering the baseline interest rate. Kelton has argued that in a slump, cutting interest rates is weak tea against depressed expectations of profits. In a boom, rising interest rates does little to quell the new activity, end quote. Do not fear for one second. I am suggesting that President Trump rigorously studied economics with MMTers like Kelton, who is, in fact, as far as I can tell, a socialist. He has probably never even heard of her. But Trump's actions do show that even Republican elected officials can fall for the allure of MMT's siren song. The Great Reset, fuel. Now, you may be thinking, Glenn, you're looking at this whole coronavirus thing completely wrong. We should be celebrating. It turns out we really can just print as much money as we want without facing any serious economic consequences. It's not like the government money printing has pushed us around, you know. It's not like the government money printing has all of us just pushing around wheelbarrows full of cash to buy a loaf of bread, like we've seen in other places like the Weimar Republic. Well, believe me, I can understand the sentiment. But I am sure that the nameless guy that was pushing the wheelbarrow to buy the loaf of bread said exactly the same thing before he had to go get his wheelbarrow. Economic catastrophes often happen so quickly that most people don't realize a problem exists until it's too late. Rapid inflation is very real and a very dangerous possibility. You should not ignore hundreds of years of economic thinking because a few governments have been able to get away with reckless spending over the course of several years or even a decade or two. Eventually, all these bad things, inflation, they catch up. They catch up with big spending governments one way or another. Further, as I'll explain more in Chapter 4, over the past few decades, the Japanese have essentially been operating under modern monetary theory. And although Japan has not experienced hyperinflation, its citizens have had to endure two decades of virtually no economic growth. The other consequence of a government printing trillions more than it takes in. But as hard as it might be to put aside the economic effects of the deficits and seemingly endless money printing, that is exactly what I'm going to ask you to do for the rest of this chapter. You see, as much as the time I spend on radio and television shows talking about the possibility of an economic catastrophe right around the corner. That is not the reason I devoted an entire chapter in this book to modern monetary theory. And as much as I care about Congress's expansion of government programs and the authoritarian coronavirus rules imposed by the little tyrants occupying so many of the governor mansions across our country, I did not rehash all of that craziness simply to comment on the harm those policies have caused. Those issues are undoubtedly important, yes, but not nearly as important as the question so many supporters of the Great Reset have been asking since the pandemic began. What comes next? Well, modern monetary theory is the extremely powerful fuel needed for the machinery of the Great Reset programs. It will be that machine and that fuel that elites will use to seize control of the world. Without the MMT fuel, tyrants have to turn to less desirable fuels like outright violence, the confiscation of land, and other often more overtly authoritarian modes of seizing control. The elites and revolutionaries throughout the West have tried over the past century to build long-lasting, stable societies using much more violent models, and it's never worked out, especially in wealthier nations like the United States. MMT offers to them a different approach. It gives the Great Reset machine the power it needs to seize control without requiring any gulags, or at least without needing many of them. And it can be put into place without the need for eliminating democracy, an essential part of making any reset scheme look tolerable to Americans. But before the MMT fuel can be poured into elites' new Great Reset tyranny machine, they must first need to get enough government officials, politicians, well-connected activists, and special interest groups, oh, and powerful business leaders, to believe that the MMT fuel actually works. As everyone who has ever accidentally put fuel, diesel fuel, into a gasoline engine, the wrong kind of fuel can leave even the best machine stranded on the side of the road. And beyond that, it might permanently damage the engine. The reason the coronavirus crisis has been so important for the Great Reset movement is because it has shown not only that modern monetary theory can be used by governments to rapidly expand government power, but also that the public in the United States is much more willing to accept modern monetary theory than many previously thought, even though most Americans have never heard of it. In the wake of the expansive quarantine easing policies that were implemented during the Obama and Trump eras, the multi-billion dollar bailouts of the banks and businesses that occurred over the past decade, the seemingly always growing national debt under both Democrat and Republican leadership, and the multi-trillion dollar government stimulus packages of the early 2010s and 2020, most Americans could not care less about government debt anymore. Those who have been clamoring now for many years to use modern monetary theory have more proof than ever that their theory can work and it will be tolerated by the public. Don't get me wrong. The proof is nothing but fool's gold. But to many of those in power, MMT is just too darn tempting to ignore. And now that modern monetary theory has been, to a large extent, normalized by the coronavirus pandemic, which again, we must continue to remind ourselves, was not what killed the economy. It was government's response to the virus that killed the economy. There's never been a better time to try to push the bounds of MMT as far as they'll go. A golden opportunity. There are at least two other reasons the pandemic has been so important for the Great Reset movement. First, it has given state and federal government officials in the United States more confidence than ever that they can enact radical, tyrannical, and even arbitrary mandates. Further, it shows that not only will many Americans go along with whatever their masters in government tell them, but they will also work with government to help silence anyone who stands up against these actions. I mean, This is the perfect recipe for a disgustingly fascist feast and cocktail. Second, it is virtually impossible to convince people that the global economy needs to be torn down and replaced with a new system when unemployment for African Americans, Hispanics, women, and just about everyone else is historically low. Retirement account values are soaring. The economy seems poised to continue growing for years to come. And that's exactly what was happening prior to the coronavirus pandemic. After the government lockdowns, though, everything changed. The economy burned to the ground, which means there's a favorable set of circumstances for elites to rebuild or reset it in an entirely new way. I want you to know this is not a theory. The loudest and most prominent voices of the Great Reset have made it abundantly clear that the global pandemic has created an incredibly important, perhaps once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, a word they keep using over and over again, to change society and the world's economy. On its own website, the World Economic Forum states, quote, "The COVID-19 crisis and the political, economic, and social disruptions it has caused is fundamentally changing the traditional context for decision-making. The inconsistencies, inadequacies, and contradictions of multiple systems, from health to financial to energy to education, are more exposed than ever amidst the global context of concern for lives, livelihoods, and the planet. Leaders find themselves at a historic crossroads, managing short-term pressures against medium and long-term uncertainties." The World Economic Forum also wrote, quote, "As we enter a unique window of opportunity to shape the recovery, this initiative, the Great Reset, will offer insights to help inform all those determining the future state of global relations, the direction of national economies, the priorities of societies, the nature of business models, and the management of global commons," end quote. Don't forget, WEF is the same nonprofit organization that in 2019 hosted the Event 201 meeting discussed earlier in this chapter, during which experts planned how government officials, international organizations, and private businesses could achieve unprecedented levels of collaboration during a future pandemic. It's also the same group that has been leading the Great Reset campaign since 2020. At the WEF launch event for the Great Reset in June 2020, Prince Charles, one of the leading supporters of the plan, called the coronavirus pandemic, quote, "a golden opportunity because people are now, quote, more receptive to big visions of change," end quote. Quote, "We have a golden opportunity to see something good from this crisis. It's an unprecedented shockwave that may well make people more receptive to big visions of change. As we move from rescue to recovery, we have a unique but rapidly shrinking window of opportunity to learn lessons and reset ourselves on a more sustainable path," end quote. Klaus Schwab, the executive chairman of the World Economic Forum, said, "COVID-19 has accelerated our transition into the age of the fourth industrial revolution. We have to make sure that the new technologies in the digital, biological, and physical world remain human-centered and serve society as a whole, providing everyone with fair access." Schwab added, quote, "This global pandemic has also demonstrated again how interconnected we are. We have to restore a functioning system of smart global cooperation structured to address the challenges of the next 50 years. The Great Reset, it will require us to integrate all stakeholders of global society into a community of common interest, purpose, and action," end quote. Sharon Burrow, the General Secretary of the International Trade Union Confederation, was interviewed by the World Economic Forum in June about the Great Reset. Referring to the COVID-19 pandemic, Burrow said, quote, "I can see how we could use this opportunity to design a better world, but we need both national and multilateral institutions to make it work." Kristalina Georgieva, the managing director of the International Monetary Fund, said in a statement about the Great Reset, quote, "We know this COVID-19 pandemic, if left to its own devices, will deepen inequality. If we were to concentrate in investing in people, in the social fabric of our societies, in access to opportunities and education for all, in expansion of global social programs, well, then we could have a world that's a better world for all. The best memorial to those who lost their lives to pandemic is a greener, smarter, and fairer world," end quote. Robert Moritz, the global chairman of PricewaterhouseCoopers, one of the world's most powerful accounting firms, has said that the coronavirus pandemic has made the, quote, "flaws in our society and global economy more apparent," end quote. In early June, Klaus Schwab, chairman of the World Economic Forum, called for a great reset following the pandemic, Moritz wrote in an article for the World Economic Forum, pressing the case for rapid collective action. Schwab said the response to COVID-19 proved that a reset of our economic and social foundation is possible. He added that now is our best chance to achieve it. "I agree," Moritz continued. "It's becoming increasingly clear that the global economy is no longer delivering what is needed. The most obvious symptoms of this breakdown include climate change, inequality, and populism. Social progress has become decoupled from economic progress. Simply put, we have a design problem. Now COVID-19 is making all the flaws even more apparent," end quote. Never let a serious crisis go to waste. As quotes discussed in the previous section of this chapter show, and there are plenty more I left out as well, many of the Great Reset's most prolific and influential backers view the coronavirus pandemic as the key opportunity and justification for enacting radical change, one that rarely comes around, as Prince Charles said during the June meeting. Quote, "It's an opportunity we have never had before and may never have again," end quote. Prince Charles and his yacht club buddies over at the World Economic Forum, they're right. The extreme and destructive nature of the policies imposed by governments in response to the pandemic have caused enough economic damage and social destabilization that ruling elites now have the chance to, in the words of Joe Biden, "build back better." More on this in Chapter 6. And the normalization and widespread use of radical monetary policies, especially those associated with modern monetary theory, have given governments the tools they need to further centralize power and put the economic decision-making in the hands of elites, in large corporations and government bureaucracies, rather than in the hands of individuals and families. The Great Reset is a very well-designed, serious plan. Terrifying to be sure, but it is one that has a real chance of working out for those who want to run every aspect of society. Rahm Emanuel would be proud. However, there is one big flaw that needs to be overcome. How can elites justify building an entirely new economy based on economic damage and societal fears linked to a temporary crisis like the coronavirus pandemic? Well, the truth is, they cannot. At least successfully, they might be able to get some of the infrastructure in place, but complete overhaul of the world? Well, it's going to take a little more work. To formulate a truly long-lasting transformation of the global economy and create, in the words of one Great Reset speaker after another, a new world order, like the one that emerged after World War II, elites hell-bent on a Great Reset need another, even more dire and dangerous crisis to solve. They need a crisis that will supposedly imperil all human life and our planet, pose an existential threat to all living things. Wow, we are so fortunate to live in a time where the supporters of the Great Reset are also the ones who believe that that climate crisis exists. If Great Reset proponents can convince the world that the only chance the human race has of lasting, not just of enjoying economic equality, social justice, and other left-wing goals, but actual survival, is to put most of the global economic power into the hands of a ruling class, well, then now you've got a crisis you can hang your obnoxiously large Russian fur hat on. This is why climate change is so important to understand, and why I've chosen it to be the topic of the next chapter.